sure that I am able to move towards something, but also be looking around for other opportunities, the more in which more opportunities reveal themselves.
Hi guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. You get a more in-depth intro as to who Jason is and what he does, and his newsletter, One Thing Better, not One Better Thing. I screwed that up in the intro, but I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Jason, thank you so much for coming on, and it was super insightful. Definitely don't forget to check out his podcast either, and follow him on Instagram. It'll all be linked in the show notes. Enjoy, guys. Hi guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Jason is not only the editor-in-chief, but also the host of the Help Wanted podcast, which I personally love, and the author of Build for Tomorrow, a book designed to help accelerate your period of reinvention. As Gary Vaynerchuk put it, Jason has access to the smartest minds in business, and in this book, he extracts their best wisdom so you can act on it now. Jason is also a keynote speaker, startup advisor, and as he puts it, a nonstop optimism machine. And because I'm sure you're going to want to hear more from him after today, please don't forget to subscribe to his newsletter, One Better Thing, where each week the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine will share one way to be more successful and satisfied and build a career and company that you love. Jason is here to tell us about his story and everything in the middle. First, Jason, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hi?
Oh, well, thanks for that very generous introduction. I appreciate it. I'm so glad you listened to Help Wanted. And for what it's worth, sorry, everything you said was great, except it's One Thing Better, not One Better Thing. Just in case somebody looks up the newsletter, you can find it at onethingbetter.email. That's a web address. Anyway, I'm so happy to be here.
Onethingbetter.email. That's exactly what I have written, except when I read it wrong. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, before we get started, why don't you go ahead and give us a little rundown of who you are and what you do in your own words?
Sure. So as editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, I oversee editorial for the brand. I'm the face of the brand, so to speak. So I'm the one who goes out and represents the brand. I spend my days talking with and meeting with entrepreneurs and trying to make sure I understand what is on their minds and how to help them. And I do that through all sorts of ways in Entrepreneur. I do, as you noted, a lot of things outside Entrepreneur. I just love connecting with entrepreneurs.
I mean, I share that hobby of yours, which is, that's why I started the podcast. I want to ask you, what kinds of things do you look for, or what kinds of questions do you ask people when you meet them? What is your kind of go-to, or, you know, just general questions?
Well, you know, I find that the most valuable conversations come out of talking about challenges. And so I very frequently we'll try to move from what are you working on to what challenges are you hitting? And look, you can't just go around and grab strangers and tell them, like ask them what's wrong in their lives and their work because they're not going to want to share. But if you create the right environment and if you're open yourself about the things that you're working on, that you're struggling with or grappling with, then people will really follow you. I mean, this is something I learned just as an interviewer in my career in media. I've worked for all sorts of media brands, men's health, fast company, and so on. And I found that as an interviewer, when you're interviewing someone, if you want them to share something open, vulnerable, thoughtful, introspective, it's so helpful to tee that up by sharing something of your own because it gives them a framework to follow and it creates a space that where they know that ideas are valued and trust is created. So that's often where I steer conversations and that's where the most interesting things are said and also where the greatest connections are made.
I agree. And I think that that is something that people can take whether or not they do media, right? That's something that is applicable to your everyday life. Every conversation you have, if you give, then you get. If you're vulnerable, you'll get vulnerability, right?
That's right.
I want to turn a little bit towards your childhood and what that upbringing for you was like and how you think your younger ages and your beginning years, because we hear a lot about your journey now, but I've heard a couple college stories from the podcast, but tell us more about that childhood and what that upbringing was like and how you think that kind of led to where you are today.
Well, I'd say the most important thing from my childhood was that my parents were just incredibly encouraging of me carving my own path. And that meant that they were supportive and they encouraged whatever direction I was going in, and they would, they would get involved in whatever it was that I was doing. They would, be excited to read my stuff. I remember when I was a little kid, I got a ham radio license, which most people probably don't even know what that is, but you can get a license from the FCC to have a ability to broadcast on a spectrum of radio signals, and people around the world talk to each other on these radio signals. It's really cool. I mean, I
It's
was mostly talking
awesome.
to like old guys with radio rigs around the world, but I did it, and then my dad got a ham radio license too, so that he could join me in that. It was,
Awesome.
it's great. So, once I got into about high school, I became very interested in writing. I started really in music journalism, and then when I went to college, I pursued a couple other paths and became the head of the college magazine, and then out of college became a local newspaper reporter, getting paid, bupkis to be a local reporter in North Central Massachusetts. And I think that when I look back at my career now, the reason I was able to get to where I am today was because I felt comfortable exploring, and the opportunities that were most valuable in my career were often not opportunities that I really recognized the value of at the moment. So, for example, I took a job at Men's Health, and at the time I thought that that was because I wanted to be in magazines, in national magazines. I look back on it now and I realize that the thing that I learned the most from Men's Health was how to speak to a reader in a service-oriented way, how to write directly
Interesting.
to a reader. But I didn't really like the way that Men's Health did it. I found that it was too much. It was too much addressing the reader, you all the time. Everything was laden up with with references to studies, and it was dense, and I just didn't love it. And some of the other writing that I learned to do, because I moved very quickly away from that, was more floral, it was more narrative. And now, years and years later, I took those two skill sets, that narrative writing and that service-driven writing, and I fused them together, where I now teach business in many ways through telling stories. I'll
Narrative.
tell a story, I'll go to a takeaway, I'll have a big idea which leads to an anecdote that you're going to remember. And I didn't understand at the time that I was building skill sets that I would later combine in a unique way. But it was my willingness to go from a men's magazine to a business magazine, which frankly I didn't care about when I first went to Fast Company, that enabled me to eventually have a broad enough skill set to be able to create something of my own. And that is what I would encourage people to do at the very beginning of their careers, is to just be totally, totally open. Malcolm Gladwell told me self-conceptions are powerfully limiting. If you're too narrow an idea of what it is that you do and are, then you will turn down all the opportunities that you don't think meet that narrow definition of self. But if you're open to it, if self-conceptions are narrowly limiting, if you have a open conception of self, then you're willing to find the path towards what you want to build for yourself.
I think that's really interesting because there's schools now, right? If you think about your formative years that have open curriculums, it's open. It's not necessarily declared right away. You're not bound to the construct of what, these couple of words say, right? Or it's not, oh, I'm majoring in this, so I must do this for the rest of my life, right? There's open for room, there's open for growth. What do you think the difference is between that sort of the line between focus and concentration and complete haphazardness and just being limited and stuck to a certain path, even if that may not necessarily be how you want to get to where you are? Did that make sense? I know that was a little like weird way of saying it, but
No, I
I
totally get what you're
formulated
saying.
it as I, yeah.
That's great. That's the best way to do questions is just figure it out on the fly. The worst thing you could do is to come into something like this with a list of questions and just stick to it, because then you're not listening to your guest and you're not responding. So I
That's exactly what I feel.
vastly, yeah, good, good. You're giving them the right information. Okay. I think that it's really valuable to have a plan, but then also have a plan to abandon the plan. And that's because whatever plan you come up with is not going to be the thing that gets you where you're happiest. But you need somewhere to move. So if you think about us all as being lost in the woods, the thing you don't want to do is walk around in a circle. That gets you nowhere. So you have to pick a direction. You got to go somewhere. And once you pick a direction, you start moving, other information will reveal itself. You'll see some smoke in the distance. You'll run into a river, something. And then you can adjust along the way. And that, I think, allows us to both have an idea of what we're moving towards, but gives us the flexibility to evolve that understanding as we go. I think we box ourselves in if we have this hyper-specific goal and then only focus on that to the detriment of everything else that could come along. So I have always liked to think for my own work about what am I building towards? Sometimes in a specific way, sometimes in an abstract way, so that I just know why I am taking the actions that I'm taking. Why am I learning this? What can it do for me next? What new opportunity does it create? And I just have to have a theory of that, just some kind of thesis. And the more that I am able to move towards something, but also be looking around for other opportunities, the more in which more opportunities reveal themselves. That does, consider a goal to be a direction, but not a roadmap. Move towards something. Always ask yourself of everything that you're doing, what is this for? So you have some answer for it. There's some reason to do this. Why am I doing this? What is it for? But the answer of what it is for could very well change over the course of you doing a project. I mean, here you are making this podcast. I presume that you have some answer to what is this for? There's some purpose that it's creating, but it's entirely possible that a year from now, the reason that you did this podcast will change. It
Oh,
will be a
absolutely.
will create some different opportunity. You'll discover that actually the podcast itself was completely useless, but you having learned how to interview people on the fly was really useful. This is just something that's going to come out of it, and you won't know unless you just put yourself in a position to do it and learn from it.
Yeah, I was listening to one of your episodes earlier today, and you were talking about direction and motion and how nothing happens if you stay stagnant and if you stay still. And it was the episode with Kara Golden, or when you shared the story, and I interviewed Kara as well, and that was one of the most powerful things that came out of it, is that she didn't take no for an answer, but she always found a way, right? Even if, this is what she wanted, that was her goal, but that wasn't the only way. She wasn't stuck and bound to that specific, way of getting there, the path, right?
The thing I love of Kara, who I've gotten to know over the years, is she has this phrase, which is, what can we do? Which is what she uses whenever anyone tells her what she can't do. And it's not in a how dare you tell me what
No,
I can't do kind of thing. It's really, at all times you will run into circumstances where something that you're trying to do, someone will say, well, that can't work. And they're right. They're right, it can't work. Or the example that Kara used in her book, the first time I saw that phrase was the very beginning. So Kara is the founder of Hint Water, in case people don't know. And Hint Water, you can find it. It's on, she's sold it, I think. But
Yeah.
it's a line of lightly flavored waters. And so at the very beginning, Kara and her husband Theo were making this stuff in her kitchen, their kitchen, and it was chemical free, no preservatives. And Theo went out to try to figure out how to manufacture and mass distribute this, and came back to Kara and said, look, I've talked to a whole bunch of manufacturers, and the answer is we can't. Like, everyone tells us
Yeah.
that it's not shelf stable. We cannot nationally distribute this. So Theo thought that that was the end. But Kara said, well, what can we do? And Theo said, well, we can make it locally and we can sell it at farmers markets. That's right. What we can do. And she said, great. Well, then that's what we'll do, because that will teach you something. That'll teach you what the demand is. It'll teach you who your consumer is, and it'll prove out whether or not there's a business here to begin with. And if there is, well, then we can figure out what the next step looks like. But if Carol wasn't willing to engage with what can we do, then that would have been the end of the project.
And I think something to note too is that sometimes the what can we do is not what you want, is less than what you think it could be. But sometimes it's important to stick with that to ultimately get to something that could be better, bigger, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, challenges are going to create learning opportunities, and they're going to force you to test in ways maybe you didn't want to test, because everyone likes an easy path. But
yeah.
Test hypotheses. It's funny. This is something that I'm thinking about right now for possibly next week's newsletter, based on a little experience I just had. So I don't know. It's just really fresh. So I'll just tell it to you. So yeah. I have off of the newsletter, I have a paid community, and in that paid community, I host these workshops, these Zoom calls where people can join in. So I had a friend of mine who's a expert in consumer psychology, whose name is Rochelle DeVoe, come and do a session for my community members on how to understand your consumers and how to understand their problems, how to understand what it is that they're looking for, so that you can relate back to them in the language that they use to understand their problems and their solutions. And when the Zoom started, it gave me a message saying that it was a 40-minute Zoom, which is a 40-minute Zooms are what you get if you have a free account, which I don't. I have a paid account, and I've never run into that problem before. And this is a 60-minute session with, you know, people who have paid me money to join these kinds of things. And so I'm like freaking out, like, why the hell does it say it's 40 minutes? What's going on? Is there a way to fix this? And I thought I fixed it while the session was going on, but I did not, because 40 minutes later, the thing just cut out. And, you know, I like had a panic attack, and I just restarted the Zoom room. Fortunately, the vast majority of the people in the room came back. We dropped some and we carried on. And I was talking to Rochelle about it afterwards. And I was like, I'm really kicking myself for having not done whatever it was that I could have.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it just didn't occur to me to check. To say, the answer was that the credit card number has changed. I need to update the credit card number in Zoom, and that's what happened. So, but Rochelle said, you know, but that was actually a really useful experiment in audience retention, because you always want to know how much of your audience is actually engaged with and willing to tolerate any friction to continue on working with you. And you don't usually want to just end a meeting in the middle and then restart to see how many people come back. But that's what happened. And as a result, you had a really interesting experiment in how many people were actively engaged. And the answer was that the majority were, and only a few dropped off. And so that's really, really useful. That's a good validation for the thing that you're doing. And I thought, well, that's a wonderful way of thinking about it, right? Like, failure is actually, you know, I often say that failure is data, but I love this thing that Rochelle introduced to me, which is the idea of the accidental experiment. That, you know, sometimes the things that we're going to learn from the most are experiments that we wouldn't actually want to run.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, there are all these science tests about, you know, like, we learn a lot from twins. You know, there's a lot that you can learn from people who share genetic material about, like, how different they are, how similar they are. And, you know, you would never as an experiment want to take twins at birth and then just separate them into different families to see what happens.
Right. Like,
that's an inhumane experiment that you would never want to run. But as it so happens, sometimes that happens. And if you can find those people, then it turned out to be a really valuable experiment that just happened to happen. And that's happening in our own lives all around us. When things go wrong, we've actually run experiments that we didn't want to run, but now they have been run, and there are things we can learn from them.
Yes, I love that. And I think that's so important too. And just like you, maintaining a positive outlook on life, right? It's so easy to cry over spilled milk. It's so easy to be like, oh, my coffee spilled. Oh, this happened. Oh, I can't believe the Zoom meeting ended, right? It's so easy to sulk in that. But taking that and making it a learning opportunity, making it something that you can grow from. And I'm sure that that's something that you can apply even in your everyday life, right? Like thinking about how can you think about that principle, use that, and apply it to the magazine, even, right? So that's my next question for you. How do you think that you or is there any examples? Are there any examples of how you've been able to turn those accidental experiments into things that you use in your daily life, in your job? Have there been any moments like that where you're like, oh, wow, that happened. I learned from that, and this is how I'm using it.
Oh yeah, sure. Plenty. Well, you asked about the magazine, so I'll give you one. When I first moved to New York, which was in 2008, and it was for my first national magazine job, which was yeah, I know, it's been a while. I was, if anyone wants to do the math, so I was 28. I had moved to New York, and I had a job at Men's Health, and to me, Men's Health was, I mean, it was still is, I guess, an enormous magazine, an enormous cultural force, and I was obsessed with magazines. And I would go out to parties or bars or whatever, and someone would ask what I do, and I would say, oh, I'm an editor at Men's Health. And they would say, that's awesome. Oh my God, it's so cool. I love Men's Health. And I would say, oh, that's great. Like, tell me something that you liked recently in the magazine. And then they would get sheepish and they would, oh, well, actually, I haven't read it in a long time, but I read it in college and I really like. And I used to think, what a loss that is. Like, that sucks. Like, there are all these people who read the magazine at some point and somehow we lost them. And our job needs to be to somehow figure out how to get them back. And I learned as my career went on that that's not a Men's Health specific problem. That's a media writ large problem. People have an affinity for traditional media brands, even if they're not engaging with that brand. And it's funny. I was just talking with a friend of mine who was on the Today Show recently, and she's like, everyone compliments me for getting on the Today Show, and I think that it's a really big deal. But also, I never watched the Today Show, and I don't know anyone who watches the Today Show. It's kind of like that. And so I, after years and years and years of thinking about this, and particularly as I've immersed myself in business and the world of entrepreneurial thinking, I've actually come to see this problem, which again exists everywhere. It's every publication I've ever worked for or freelance for has this same problem. That includes the entrepreneur. I've come to see it as an opportunity. And the opportunity is that there's tremendous brand affinity that goes far beyond the consumer base of the product. So let's just say that our total addressable market is, I don't know, and just is I'm just making things up, 500 million people, right? But our actual engaged audience are the s considerably smaller number of millions of people who read the website every month or pick up the magazine or engage with some of our content, right? So that means that we have not just a hypothetical market of people who we could reach. We have a lot of people who we have reached in some way, who know the brand, who trust the brand, who trust me when I show up in front of them giving a keynote talk, who think that the brand has some value for them, but don't actively engage with the brand. And it doesn't make any sense for us to try to figure out how to just bring them back to the product that they've made a decision not to consume, right? Maybe they don't like reading magazines. Maybe they don't feel like they need the website. What else? What else can we produce for them? Where are the opportunities to create new products or services, to partner, to create new companies, to do things that are going to reach these people and serve them where they are? Because the brand affinity is so strong that we have a head start on attracting them, on building trust with them, on doing the kinds of things that other brands would have to spend a ton of money and effort and time trying to boot up towards. That's a huge opportunity. That is not a loss. That is a possible gain. That's something that I am now spending a lot of time thinking about as an entrepreneur.
That's so interesting. And I think that all comes back to the question is what can we do? Right? Like sure, we're not getting them this way, but what else, what
That's right.
more, what can we do?
That's right. Great way to bring it back to that.
Yeah. So let me ask you, what are some things that you think would be helpful for people who are, I'm going to ask you two things actually. For
Sure.
people who are trying to build the brand, right? And who are trying to gain that retention and have that audience and have that trust with their community, what do you think is useful for them? And how do you think that once you have that trust, you can keep it there and keep the brand going, whatnot, right? Like these other mediums that we're talking about.
Yeah. So I mean, look, it all comes down to communication with your customer. Like the number one thing that you can do when you're starting something is to just get some kind of minimum viable product out into the world and then very actively talk to your customer about it. You want to understand what were they doing at the time in which they found you or were finding or were looking for a solution. Like, what was the problem in their life? And how has it helped them? Because ultimately what you want to do, and this is work that I'm just repeating from my friend Rochelle DeVoe, who I just mentioned a minute ago because she does consumer insights research. So she has this framework I just really, really love. Okay, so you want to be able to, in your customer's words, be able to fill in this sentence. When something happens, context, when trigger happens, when something happens, I want solution. What's the solution? So that benefit. When context happens, I want solution. So that benefit. So, for example, she gave this example of a compression sock company that she helped. So it would be like, when my feet hurt from standing all day, I want to feel comfortable while still looking cute, because it was a female-driven brand, so that I can do my job, be present for my family, and enjoy my life while not standing out because you're hobbling around on your feet or something, right? Now, the important reason to do that kind of work, to talk to your customers in this way so that you can fill that out, is because once you understand that and you understand that benefit, you can start to talk to them with the benefit first, right? Because nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want compression socks. What they wake up in the morning thinking is, I want to do my job well and be present for my family and enjoy my life while not standing out. That's what they say. And compression socks, for people who have, feet pain, foot pain, compression socks can help them do that. So you need to work backwards from the thing that people want and the benefit that they get. And so the more that you understand your customer, the more you are able to shape the product for them, but also use their language in the marketing that you use to communicate with them.
And that comes back again to what you were saying about language and communication, is just talking to your customer and understanding them too. Because if you don't know who your customer is, then that's the first issue, right? But as long as you know who your customer is and how to speak to them, then that's really how to get to the root of the problem, right?
Yeah, and you probably don't know them as well as you think you do, which is the reason you should be talking individually to them.
How often do you talk to your customers?
Every day, to be
Every
honest.
day.
I mean, there are two ways for me to answer that. There's the newsletter, for example. When somebody joins my community, they get a link to book a one-on-one call with me. And these are incredibly time consuming. I mean, I just had one like an hour before hopping on this podcast with you. Incredibly time consuming. My calendar is just full of these things. But there's nothing more valuable than having one-on-one conversations with people so that I can understand, why did you join this? And what are you hoping to get out of it? I ask them, a year from now, what would have happened to make this have been worth your money and time? And I glean patterns from this. I've learned, for example, that people who are attracted to my work and particularly attracted enough to pay money to join the community are all going through some kind of transition in their work right now. Sometimes it's a big transition, sometimes it's small, but they perceive themselves as having gone through or being go going through some kind of transition. They're looking for some kind of acceleration towards doing more of the work that they love. They want both soft and hard skills to get there. When I understand that, oh, and they really want to connect with others. It turns out a lot of people feel very isolated and they're looking to connect with others who are like-minded. And they think that a community full of people who are reading a newsletter that they like will have a lot in common with them. that's really useful stuff. Like that by itself has helped me shape the product, lean more heavily into community. I didn't even call it a community when I first launched it in November, but now that's the word that I use. But I don't think it's the word I'll use forever because, again, people don't wake up in the morning and say, I want community, right? They wake up in the morning and say something else. So I'm trying to understand the language, but that's where I am right now.
That's awesome. That is very, very awesome. And there was one burning question I had for you specifically. I know we're running out of time. I want to be very mindful of your time. So my last question for you is, you help all these people reinvent themselves. You help all these people accelerate their careers and get to where they want to be. Can you tell us about a time where you were going through that transition and when you were trying to reinvent yourself?
Oh, sure. I mean, look, the person that you're talking to right now is the product of that reinvention. When I became editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, I really only understood myself as a media person. I had had a career in national media. I took that job to work on a media product to help rethink and revitalize a magazine. And I understood myself as having value in the media space. And the starting point for a reinvention was when people started to interview me. They'd reach out like you did and invite me onto their podcasts or onto their stages or onto their TV shows or something. And they would treat me, as you are doing, as an authority in the space. And I was deeply uncomfortable with that because I didn't have a business background in the way that traditional, you know, start your own business entrepreneurs did. I came from media, not from startup founding. And so I felt inadequate and unprepared to speak in that kind of way and present myself as an authority. I also hadn't been trained to do that. A media person is generally trained to be behind the story, not to be in front of the story. Be the story. So but after a while and after stumbling through a lot of interviews, my wife said this funny thing to me, which was, if they want you to be a thought leader, then be a thought leader. And I realized I needed to understand the thing that people expected from me. And if I could become that person, that character, then there was actually a much larger opportunity set on the other side of it. Wow. Because right now, as a media person, I'm really only qualified to do media projects. But if I can speak with authority on a broad range of subjects, it leads to, who knows back then? I didn't know, but I'll tell you the answer, you know, however many years in, which is that what that leads to is first of all, the ability to create authoritative work yourself. So I've made money off of my books and my speaking and my podcast and my newsletter. But also you start to find your way into people's lives and companies in other ways. So people pay me for consulting. I have equity in startups for advising. And now I'm in the process of building some new companies myself. So all of that wouldn't have been possible had I not been open to a reinvention that was scary and required rethinking a lot of, who am I to other people? What is my skill set? What is my idea base? How do I talk? How do I relate to people? But it was completely worth that effort.
That's awesome and very, very inspirational, because I think a lot of times you also get a little bit like imposter syndrome. Oh, I'm not supposed to be here. Oh, I probably shouldn't be talking about this. Oh, you know, but if you step into that role with that confidence too, it makes it easier and you start doing it slowly but surely. And then it leads to something bigger. It leads to something better. And I would love to hear also what some of those projects are that you're working on.
Oh, well, yeah, I would love
and
to
if you're
share,
allowed
but
to,
I'm,
if you're
I'm
allowed
not
to.
At the like things that I'm building right now, it's too early. We haven't launched anything. So we're in early mode, but stay tuned.
We will be. And everyone will know how to. Everything will be linked in the show notes. Jason, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for being here and chatting with us. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'll just say that web address again, because that's a great way to get in touch with me, which is onethingbetter.email. That one thing about our email is you get my newsletter and then you could just respond to the emails and I get them. So anyway, but thank you so much. This is such a great conversation.
I'm gonna stop recording and we can chat for a second, and then sure. I will also make sure that everything will be linked in the show notes so that you guys can everyone will just be able to click on.
Jason, thank you so, so much for coming and chatting with us today. I hope you guys enjoy today's episode. Again, Jason, it was an honor to speak with you. And yeah, I will see you all next week for another episode. Bye, guys.